I just want to, I also understand that we might want to do some other things besides the formal interview. Show you.
Well, a lot more.
Yeah.
In terms of, if you're a historian, and my interest is the history of our department and all of the things that it's done, and not only that related to addiction research, and we can get into that as well.
Yeah. Okay. So I'd like you, if you could, start by characterizing what the field of pharmacology looked like when you entered it. So can you tell me the story of what your pathway was into pharmacology?
Well, my pathway into pharmacology was through medicine and medical school. So I got involved very early once I realized that there is a subject called pharmacology at the University of Illinois in Chicago.
And can you tell me, in terms of professional status at that time, where would you have placed medicine and pharmacology?
Together at a very high level, because my introduction to pharmacology was primarily clinical pharmacology, or the application of drugs in humans. And in fact, the chairman of pharmacology was an MD, PhD, who was a colleague of Mo Sievers, and that's Carl Pfeiffer, and then Klaus Unna, an MD from Germany originally, was another then physician type who spent all of his efforts in pharmacology. Julius Last, I can just go on and on and on with the number of people in pharmacology that were MDs, and in fact across the line between animal research and human research back and forth. And in fact, if you did work in animals, which was very appropriate, and then you then carried on those that research, whatever was ethical, in humans you did that. And so to me, pharmacology was clinical pharmacology, and a model, in fact, for the possibility of a job in this area. So very soon after my sophomore year, or during my sophomore year.
And what year was that?
Well, they I started medical school in 1947. Pharmacology started in 1948. But I had another input into pharmacology based on my background in electronics.
Yes, and can you tell me how you acquired that background in electronics?
Through the U.S. Navy during the World War II, when I got out of high school. In fact, I decided that I would go into chemical engineering. It was 1942 that I graduated. And then it turned out that I went into chemical engineering because I liked it a lot. Spent a year there, and then of course with the war going on, I decided to volunteer. In fact, my draft board was extremely distressed with me because I was in Chicago. There were plenty of volunteers, and they wanted me to continue in college, and I chose not to. And instead, at the end of my first year at the University of Illinois in Urbana, Champaign-Urbana, I decided to volunteer, and I joined the Navy. And I was hoping to get something related to chemistry. And in fact, they found out that I had a hobby, which was amateur radio.
And you had had that in high school?
Yes. Well, I was interested in crystals and radios.
Yes.
And all.
I have an uncle like you.
But the bottom line to all of this is that as a result of my interest in electronics, and really at that time just radio, they put me into electronics, and to my utter astonishment, when I got out of boot camp, they decided to put me to go to Wright Junior College in Chicago, of all places. Since I grew up in Chicago, I couldn't believe it. They sent me back to Wright Junior College for early training in electronics, and then from there, advanced training in electronics in at the Naval Research Laboratories in Anacostia, Washington, D.C. And as a result, I ended up being a electronics technician throughout World War II. So I was on a large, heavy cruiser, USS Pittsburgh. Well, first a light cruiser, USS Pasadena, then a heavy cruiser, all doing my electronics thing. And during the war, I decided, well, maybe electronics and maybe chemistry is not exactly where I want to go, and decided during that time to go to medical school. So I made a career change while still in the Navy, and by the time I got out, I decided to go to medical school. Of course, there the GI Bill provided a little bit of money, but I'm also at the same time I'm going out with my girlfriend. We decided to get engaged, and then subsequently get married. And now I needed money.
Yeah.
So I ended up, believe it or not, working in my summers, doing all kinds of odd jobs what I could get, and in fact ended up during my first year between first year medical school and second year medical school, doing a year a summer in physiology, where I did renin assays. I'll never forget it as long as I live. That's all I did, is hypertension and renin assays. And then I started my sophomore year, and that's where I first learned about a field called pharmacology. And it's then that I heard that Carl Pfeiffer, the head of department, decided to buy a brainwave machine. And they needed somebody in the electronics area to work the following summer, or possibly during the year, to actually set up a brainwave machine or electroencephalograph. Mm-hmm. And so I was hired by Carl Pfeiffer. And another fellow that was hired is subsequently was, in fact, Bill Martin. So Bill Martin and I were then, we ended up as graduate students in pharmacology. That's, we both of us got our MDs, we both got our, I got it first, then he later, our master's of degrees in pharmacology as well as MD degrees. Because Dr. Pfeiffer felt very strongly that we needed MDs in the field of pharmacology. And so he recruited many, many medical students in that regard. So all of a sudden now I'm a brainwave specialist.
Now, Martin had a similar background with radio?
He also was in electronics. My understanding is he was in the Army. Mm-hmm. And had a electronics background. And in fact, he was also hired. I was hired first, and then he was hired. And the two of us then were very, we worked a lot together. And in fact, I helped him get his master's degree. I'm very proud of that.
Can you tell me that story?
It's a very interesting story, and which is that Bill, in fact, decided to get a master's degree, as I did, in pharmacology. Both of us were under the Professor Klaus Unna, who was a neuropharmacologist, very interested in a variety of both fields, both central and peripheral, and that's the Klaus Unna of nalorphine fame.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to the nalorphine story.
Well, I could keep you here all day.
I know you could. That's why I was glad you scheduled so much time.
But the bottom line to all of this is that it turned out that Bill had to get a, or wanted to get a master's degree in pharmacology, as I was getting one. But he didn't have enough data, but he had some data that Dilantin, phenytoin, had some different effects on brain waves than did phenobarbital. So I actually spent, Dr. Unna actually insisted that I help Bill with a bunch of experiments in which I did, and it was all his work, of course.
And you had you already gotten your master's degree?
I was in the process of getting it. I don't remember the details, but I was a year ahead of him.
Yeah, so you ended up doing a bunch of work on his master's degree.
Then helping him. No, he helped me. I mean, we were very good
I was
going to
ask you about your relationship,
friends.
Working relationship.
We were good professional colleagues.
And would you say that better than, did you know him better than you knew other graduate students? Or
By far.
Yeah.
We worked together.
Yeah.
By far.
What about, I gather that Carl Pfeiffer and Klaus Unna had different styles.
Totally different, but complemented each other.
And
Carl Pfeiffer was a dreamer. He was a thinker-dreamer. He had these wild ideas, which always led him into trouble, I might add, over the years, because he then became ultimately an orthomolecular psychiatrist. I don't know if you know that story, but in his old age, that's the way he ended up. Nevertheless, he would always have these wonderful theories that frequently were so wild that as a graduate student, you'd love to test them and should prove them wrong. So many of us would use that as a challenge to see if his ideas are correct or not. Klaus Unna, totally different. Klaus Unna, on the other hand, was not that much of a theoretician coming up with new ideas, but rather one who really concentrated on making sure that whatever you did was done properly and in a kind of a German tradition. It was a classical German Schmiederberg pharmacology tradition.
So would you describe Pfeiffer as a theoretician?
But also a theoretician, but also very interested in doing hands-on research. He was a combination of both. And in fact, if you have a moment, let me show you something. Just shut it off.
Oh, I'll let it run. It's
well,
long. But
here's something that I, in going through my many, many things, as I'm going through different things, take a look at this wonderful photograph and see what you think of it. There's Carl Pfeiffer with his mouth open. And now there's, in fact, Harry Williams, another graduate student, and also got his MD at the University of Chicago, where in fact I think Carl Pfeiffer got a degree there as well. It's a complex story, but in any event, here's Harry giving LSD 25 to Dr. Pfeiffer at Emory University, 1955.
I see that. So now, clearly, the photograph is staged.
Well, it probably is staged, but nevertheless, it's absolutely. But I can tell you that Carl Pfeiffer probably took more LSD, probably in this format, than probably any other scientist that I know.
Yes.
And he did. He felt very strongly that what is done in animals carries on into human beings, and had no hesitancy to say if it was a safe drug that the first human being to take it should
yes.
be the investigator.
Yes.
So I grew up in an environment where, in fact, I can tell you a story related to my own experiences where I'm the first human being who took a number of drugs simply because I worked on them.
Please
I knew
do.
They were safe. Well, that's a separate story. But in any event, I think it illustrates the kind of a guy that Carl Pfeiffer was. And it, to me, a superb administrator, a superb, a teacher who would come up with a lot of ideas that usually were kind of crazy side. They were way out ideas. They weren't in the mainstream. But that's what made him exciting, because as a result, you're likely to go to the laboratory and do some animal research to see if his ideas are valid or not.
Yes.
On the other hand, Klaus Unna completely different.
Yeah.
And of course, I was very much attracted to both of them,
mm-hmm.
but I ended up with Klausuna as the more disciplined, scientific. You got to give me the facts, what the facts are, be super critical. And in fact, he was far more critical of everybody's research, including his own.
Mm-hmm.
He believed
okay.
nothing. I mean,
and what did he think about Carl Pfeiffer?
Superb man.
Yeah, so despite the very different...
Different style,
yeah.
totally different. And in fact, he and Sievers, very close friends. This is very important.
Yes, who...
Sievers and I think was older than Carl Pfeiffer, but they were very, whether their original training was at University of Chicago as well as Wisconsin, I don't know those details.
Mm-hmm.
At least I...
Yeah, where did they run into each other?
Probably, I don't know whether it was in Wisconsin or probably Chicago, but
right.
I'm not certain of that. But the bottom line is they were very good friends, and the wives were friends, etc. And that's one of the reasons I got a job at Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this
mm-hmm.
is the network very
yes.
much involved, both of them.
And if you had to characterize Sievers, would you characterize him as more... like Pfeiffer's style or more like Klausuna's style?
A Pfeiffer that's more practical
mm-hmm.
and more down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
One who didn't have as many way out ideas, but essentially had the big picture and his and the big picture in terms of what it's all about in relationship to humanity and society.
Yes,
and,
so Sievers always had that.
Sievers always had the view of what's good for society and very strong opinions on a lot of subjects, but
mm-hmm.
that's
mm-hmm.
Sievers, and so influenced by all of these guys.
And what about Sievers in relation to the self-administration?
He would do it as well,
mm-hmm.
But not as much. Sievers, who's the first person who ever took diphenhydramine, Benadryl?
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, it was Mo Sievers himself. After Park Davis did all of the basic science work on diphenhydramine as an antihistaminic, they needed to introduce it to human beings, and the first guinea pig was Mo Sievers himself. And he was very proud of the fact that he was the first to take diphenhydramine. And in fact, one of the reasons I ended up at Michigan, in part, was that Dr. Sievers needed an MD, because human research for teaching, and especially for teaching in medical school students, was extremely important. At that time, he needed someone with an MD background. There's a story related to why I came, because I, in a way, replaced another very important a number of MDs, and that was Chenoweth, who then left Ann Arbor, Michigan, to go to Dow. And there was an opening that I filled, which was needed, because as an MD, we did a lot. We would get students drunk. I'd show them the effects of alcohol. We'd show them the effects of sedatives, stimulants, it's amphetamine.
You would show them, meaning they would experience it, or you would demonstrate?
This is a teaching demonstration for 200 medical students in front of an entire medical class. We would have laboratory sessions involving human administration of a large variety of drugs.
And who would be the subjects?
The students themselves.
Right. And they would sort of volunteer?
They would volunteer for taking various drugs.
Right.
And this was very done on a very ethical, appropriate circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
There were no human use committees then, but medical school administrators knew from exactly what was going on. In fact, that ultimately created a problem, because we would have medical students that were drunk from ethyl alcohol, as an example, and then they had to go to class. We'd do that in the morning, and then they'd have to go to class somewhere else in the afternoon, and they're still a little intoxicated. And so a number of issues related to the whole business of human research and the ethics of human research which and that involves many things, including research in prisons, etc.
Yes.
There's a big change, not only in terms of introducing more than guidelines with regard to human research, but the bottom line is, Sievers, we're coming back to that, saw the big picture, but again, an MD, PhD, who felt very strongly there's a place for human demonstrations, human mm-hmm. research, etc.
Mm-hmm. So, in your story that you told me previously about nalorphine, you mentioned that demonstrations were done on dogs, that you all those kinds of demonstrations,
well,
on animal demonstrations.
Well, as at the University of Illinois,
yes.
Nalorphine, since it was Carl Zuna actually did the major work at Merck with showing the detailed pharmacology of nalorphine than we were doing, and that's part of my job, as well as many others, mm-hmm. of demonstrating in dogs a overdose of morphine and then giving nalorphine.
So the demonstrations were common. I mean, many medical schools probably did them.
It was essential
mm-hmm.
As a method of teaching, and that is, by the way, is what made Dr. Sievers very considered almost a genius, a god in Japan, because after World War II, when he went to Japan, he actually brought some nalorphine with him, and he knew it was an antagonist by then of morphine, and so he would go to different Japanese universities and ask that they poison a dog with an overdose of morphine, and then he would give nalorphine, and incredibly the dog would wake up, and the Japanese pharmacologists realize they are far backward compared to what's happening in the United States, and as a result they decided to change their whole system of education. Of course, that's part of the whole MacArthur then period, in which then the Japanese began to take on a lot of the types of university and teaching, etc., that was then done in the United States, and that included medical schools.
Mm-hmm.
And Sievers was part of that medical school then group that advised the Japanese on redoing their medical schools. And in fact, pharmacology then and clinical pharmacology all kind of were related.
Yeah. I want to follow up on Sievers' trip to Japan just a little bit before we go back to your...
By the way, I have a picture of Dr. Sievers somewhere of injecting a dog that's poisoned with morphine and as an overdose, and then in which he gives nalorphine.
You have a lot of original photographs.
The answer is, I have them somewhere in boxes and wherever. And if you had the time for a month or two to go through everything, you'd be more than welcome.
I might take you up on that, because you
be prepared to take off, a four-drawer file full of materials, which I could easily provide you as of today.
it's hard. We would have to figure out what is happening with the material, but it seems like it would be invaluable to actually organize
it. Well, let me tell you, the problem at University of Michigan is storage, and as a result, we have a major loss of material in terms of the University of Michigan over the years. And I'm involved actually in trying to preserve the history of jazz, as a matter of fact, with a very wonderful program, Jazz Revisited, in which Hazen Schumacher, as an example, had thousands upon thousands of records which the University of Michigan found no room for.
And so,
and
where
ultimately, they ended up. Fortunately, there was a German who, in Hamburg, Germany, who was able to take the entire collection, really worth millions and millions of dollars, which was given, of course, as a gift by Hazen to this museum. Just this is an example of the situation the University of Michigan is in. Preservation of historical documents is something that is not possible due to the lack of space. We just don't. Our poor university has a wonderful way of getting rid of super documents. Maybe Google will save us. I don't know.
Yes. Well, I actually have some thoughts on that.
Well, that's a separate issue.
We should come back to.
And let me make it very clear. I've never viewed myself as an addiction researcher. I've never been in the organization and politics of addiction simply because I viewed myself as really, well, I was more interested in what I would call clinical pharmacology in a bigger perspective. And although drugs of abuse have always been a major, in fact, no question about it, area of my research, I've never been in really the organizations that
CPDD.
Really were involved with addiction research because my interests were much broader. I just want to know how the body works and how we can make things that are better in those situations where there is disease. And for a variety of reasons, I've ended up doing much more brain research than I have other kinds of research, but I can be turned on by any kind of research.
Would you say that over the course of your career, the field of, quote, addiction research, the limited field of addiction research, has gone that direction, has gone towards, well, wait a second, this is a brain disease, this is a much bigger issue than addiction?
Well, it always has, I think, been that. But the focus of people, especially focus of people like Mo Seavers, was always this is his major contribution and major interest, although he did have many other interests, of, including the place of pharmacology in medicine, and the fact that he felt very strongly that pharmacology is a bridge into the clinical areas, but equally was very important in bringing in more PhDs into the field because he realized the need for such people. And in fact, people like Bob Schuster, Jim Woods, these are all indeed examples of the vision that Mo Seavers had in getting a very strong group of PhDs and a very good PhD program here at the University of Michigan, which not only was important in addiction research, but all kinds of pharmacologic research.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I want to actually go back and finish up your graduate school experience. Besides Bill Martin, there were other people in that department who ended up becoming major figures in the field. Can you talk a little bit about
them? Well, there were the one of the let me begin by saying there were a lot of MD masters type students. Carl Pfeiffer felt very strongly that as I said earlier, that we ought to have MDs in the field. And as a result, made it very easy for people going through medical school to get a master's in pharmacology. In fact, all you had to do is to spend up to 3 summers doing research, and during the school year, take graduate courses along with medical school courses. And the graduate courses were that were given really fit in very well in terms of a time sequence that you could easily do this. It just meant an extra load. As a result, I think there were dozens of students during that Pfeiffer period that got combined degrees. Usually they would end up not as MD PhDs, but rather MD Masters, because, in fact, I'm a good example. Bill Martin's another one. In fact, we were told, why get a PhD when you got your MD and you got your Masters? You have enough of a background. You need to get to work and do some science and publish papers, get some good research done instead of worrying about getting a PhD. So many of us were discouraged from going further, and but on the other hand, encouraged to the hilt to pursue mm-hmm. whatever we wished to do. And a number of the people went into medical, clinical fields, and a number then stayed in basic pharmacology type departments. Ed Pelican is such an example, who then went to Boston and stayed there for many years. And there are many others, but I think Bill Martin is the best example.
Was Ralph Gerard there?
No, Ralph, that's a nice story. Ralph Gerard was a professor of physiology, University of Chicago. There was the Chicago connection. Mm-hmm. University of Chicago was a very strong connection. The two chairs were very friendly. In fact, all of the pharmacology department chairs were very friendly with each other. They knew each other. There was a good exchange. I believe then Harry Williams, I believe, was more at University of Chicago and yet did a lot of the work at University of Illinois and Chicago. I mean, it was that mm-hmm. sort of a mm-hmm. back and forth relationship.
And Keith
Henry
Clamp?
Swain is another, by the way.
Yeah, sure.
Here, who got an MD as well as a master's degree, and in fact, was in the cardiovascular area here in our department for many years, mm-hmm. and eventually became an associate dean and subsequently retired.
So did most of you pick up PhDs at some point or not?
No, not at all.
That's interesting.
No, we were essentially told from mm-hmm. That was kind of the philosophy. You're an MD, go on and get your MD training, and if you want to end up in pharmacology, and then pick up a master's. And if you choose to continue in pharmacology, fine. If you go more clinical, that's fine. That's your business.
Mm-hmm.
But it was with the idea of getting out a lot more medical students to really understand drugs. And by the way, I think that's a crisis in the United States and maybe in the world.
I'll say.
We don't have enough MDs who are really experts in pharmacology, and we need more.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the whole field of pharmacology is changing, so that really the PharmD is becoming the more going to be in the future, if this continues, more of the dominant force in the education of medical students in terms of pharmacology or simply internists,
mm-hmm.
as is apparently the case that's happening here at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tragedy. The field mm-hmm. of pharmacology has so changed that, and I think the chairs of pharmacology are so interested in getting grants from the federal government or elsewhere, that their primary mission is to make their department financially in the positive. And as a result, the whole role of pharmacology in teaching of medical students is near zero. And the worst tragedy is Michigan itself. We only have 20 hours total of pharmacology for 4 years of medical school. Unless they take my course or they take Dr. Lucchese's course, which is for seniors as a voluntary course, which seems to be being taken over, at least the clinical therapeutics course being taken over by clinicians. There's a tragedy.
Yeah.
And no one in pharmacology, no one, meaning none of the younger people are worried about it. Their worry is to get a grant and survive.
Mm-hmm.
Survival of the fittest.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough area.
So how would you narrate the, I don't know, ascension and decline of the fortunes of the field of pharmacology across your career?
Well, I think pharmacology is a discipline, and the knowledge base has been enormous. I mean, if it weren't for for the research that has been done, especially by many, many PhDs, we would never be at the state of knowledge that we are today. I mean, there's no question about it. But I think the fortune of pharmacology departments and their impact on medical education and perhaps education in other fields such as dentistry is, I think, and osteopathy decreasing. And the impact, at least in terms of having specialists in that field teach their students, for example. If you're in a medical school, I think medical students ought to be your primary education base for teaching. That's not true. All graduate student base is considered by far the most important.
Right.
And that's replication of the species, which is currently replication of more and more PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but what I'm saying is that I think pharmacology is losing its importance in a medical education.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tragic, because can you imagine your own doctor graduating from medical school and going on and doing a residency or whatever, learning the drugs in that field, and then being totally ignorant of pharmacology, other than what he's been taught by other clinicians.
Yes.
But that's the status of medical education and doctors right now. We have a crisis in this country, and no one seems to care about it.
Would you attribute that in any way to the undue influence of the pharmaceutical industry?
No, I think that's there's a major problem of how do you now transmit the knowledge base to medical students that are going into the field, and the knowledge base is so enormous there's a real problem as to how much one should teach in every given area. And as a result, it turns out that with the pressures for universities to be in the positive, meaning financially and on the positive side, the pressure to generate grant funds and the magical figure of 50-53% overhead, which then goes to universities, is a pressure that forces, I think, most institutions to concentrate their major mission not on teaching, but their major mission on research.
Mm-hmm.
That's true of our department.
Yeah.
And teaching is of graduate students is key to the success of professors being able to sit in front of their computers and type grants all day long, while the students are sitting and are working in the laboratories doing the research.
Yeah, so it's a change in the social organization.
The whole social organization has changed, and whether it will continue to get in this direction, who knows? It's up to society.
Yeah,
but it's a major problem.
So could you now talk a little bit about as when you were in graduate school, what were the relationships between your mentors and the pharmaceutical industry? How much did they consult? What sorts of?
There was a very healthy relationship. When I went through medical school and subsequently thereafter for a short period of time, there was no NIH. There were no government funds per se, unless they were in very special areas. And pharmaceutical industry at the same time did not have enough experts in the field in developing new drugs. And so there was a need for pharmaceutical industry to have consultants. And many of the pharmacologists, whether they were MDs or PhDs, always had consultations with the industry. Pfeiffer, UNA, all the people I knew at Illinois were consultants to industry, and likewise getting grants from industry in a very wonderful situation. I've had wonderful experiences with working primarily with Klaus UNA and the research grants that he got through at that time, Smith, Klein, and French Laboratories, which ultimately I ended up getting my master's degree doing structure-activity relationships related to a series of benzazoles that are skeletal muscle relaxants that act centrally, of which there are a few compounds that have survived, but not many, from a therapeutic point of view. But the relationship was a very good one, a very healthy one, and one that was, in fact, I grew up in, that was very important. They're a source of research money. Mm-hmm. And likewise, once the research was done, they get their patent on a drug or whatever they wanted to do. Then from then on, you publish all your data, and it was a good relationship.
So you had to wait to publish until they got the patent?
Or that was the decision of the companies, and that mm-hmm. was understandable, but that usually they get their patents wrapped. That was not a problem. I, mm-hmm. If you look at my master's thesis, a entire structure relationships of like 50 compounds that were synthesized. These days you really wouldn't be able to find that kind of stuff other than usually in areas that a drug company considers totally dead and useless, and then it'll be published in detail.
Yeah.
My recollection is that one of the derivatives that we thought was important was patented, and then the other compounds were structure-activity relationships, and as a matter of fact, other companies then took off on the structure-activity relationships that I actually published and developed other compounds that were kind of, not me too, but slightly different, mm-hmm. and my God, they were very, very useful, mm-hmm. at least for a time being. Mm-hmm. But it's a different world, and in fact, the best example is that drug industry now is like a prison. To get in or get out is almost impossible unless you go through a series of guards, because that's the nature of the industry these days. They're all so scared of competition and letting out trade secrets and things.
About
of that
when
type.
Would you say that changed?
I think it's a gradual change. It's a change over the years, depending on what company it is. And there are some companies that I probably shouldn't mention that are the worst in the world in their mm-hmm. ability to concentrate on the dollar bill and nothing else. And I might add, those usually are the most successful ones. Mm-hmm.
In terms of the marketplace?
The marketplace then determines the success, and once that compound or those companies get success, they tend to buy out other companies, etc. And companies that are very dear to my heart, like Park Davis, are all long gone.
Long gone.
Upjohn, gone.
Yes.
And when we were young, getting compounds from drug companies was the name of the game. There was no problem in getting whatever chemical you wanted. I mean, it was.
And there was a relationship. How did you go about getting the compounds from them? What was the?
Well, if you didn't know someone at a given drug company, then you'd go really through your chairperson, who really knew. I mean. Working with the people that I knew that were my chairman in the old days, they knew every, you know, I needed anything, they'd always have somebody in the world they would know where to get the compounds, etc. Mm-hmm. And that whole, because they were all consultants. Mm-hmm.
Right. So the social networks now are completely different.
Completely different. And it isn't at the level. You may be a consultant for a drug company in which you sign off, agreements that you don't. It's secret, but it's so secret that really most companies don't even publish their data unless it's so negative that it doesn't, or they've gotten their patent and they're so happy with that they'll mm-hmm. publish because mm-hmm. they want to develop it further for clinical use and make a lot of money on it. But the entire field has changed to the detriment of the field.
So I want to go back to, we didn't really get into the nalorphine story. I want to go back to you leave graduate school. You finished your master's.
My story is as follows, and that is that I decided I was going to go on to get clinical work. I made the decision that pharmacology was a wonderful field, but I'm going to be a doc. I'm going to be a doc, probably in practice. And I decided to take a internship, as we all did. For a variety of reasons, although I was considering a lot of wonderful places like Seattle and Madison, Wisconsin, and so on for my clinical training, I ended up getting I decided to stay in Chicago because I had a my family, my wife's family were all in Chicago, and I got an internship at Presbyterian Hospital, which is part of Press St. Luke's. That's the old Rush Medical School.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And it was good because I wanted a more private practice type medical school relationship as opposed to Cook County and the more county hospital kind of training that I had gotten as a undergraduate medical student at Illinois. And amazingly, they needed a instructor in pharmacology, so Carl Pfeiffer came up with a beautiful proposal that I actually split my internship over a two-year period with another colleague at Pelican, who also, I might add, ended up in pharmacology, in which I took an internship over a two-year period. And that's where I then did my clinical training at Presbyterian Hospital. And back to nalorphine. If I cry, you'll know why.
Yes.
I was on a oncology service, and my job was to take care of people with cancer. They're all dying. They're in terrible pain, and hopeless cases. The whole idea was to get them as comfortable as possible and prepare them for their death. And subsequent referral to nursing homes for terminal care. And that service I'll never forget. I had a woman who had cancer of the breast, and the cancer was totally disseminated throughout her body. She was in terrible pain, and my job on the oncology service was to give her narcotics. Attending was a Dr. Trout, an internist, who had an interest in developing, at a clinical point of view, testing drugs that he hoped were narcotics that would be less addicting. And was involved with comparing in his oncology service morphine to other narcotics. And one of them was Dromaran, and of which there's a DNL form, and levorphanol is the active form of Dromaran. But in any event, it turned out that one of the things that I did is that we were using then this narcotic combination and for a group of patients that were being treated. And it was very effective analgesic. But it was just like morphine, but more potent. In terms of milligram dose, but a very effective agent for treating pain.
And whose drug was it?
I if you look up levorphanol now,
okay,
you can go
I'll
to the
that.
Merck Index. I'm not sure at the moment.
So he was basically doing clinical small-scale clinical trials on this.
That is correct, but
what we would call phase four, late stage.
No, I would say they're really almost phase two. Phase two. Well, remember, this is before the FDA.
I understand.
And the different phase systems. But in any event, Trout was one of those clinicians who, in fact, was comparing different analgesic agents, trying to get something better than morphine. Mm-hmm. That's the whole idea. And as a result, I ended up with a series of patients in which were given a morphine, but others given Dromaran, etc. And I was ending up giving Dromaran. And I'm totally responsible. Okay, I'm totally responsible. I'm not only the intern, I'm the resident, and my contact is the attending. I'm dealing directly with the attending. And the attending is super busy in the hospital, but extremely busy. And I'm responsible. I really am the doc in charge. Turns out this lady had no family. All alone. Dying. Bad shape. And I'm treating her, and she's doing well. She's from the point of view of pain relief, she's doing very well. And I have to continue giving her more. I'm giving her more and more. Okay. And then I get a phone call, or actually over the loudspeaker system, emergency for me. I run to answer it, and a nurse is giving this lady artificial respiration. I run to her, see what's going on. Pupils are constricted. She's not breathing. We're ventilating her, and I realize, Christ, I overdosed her. Well, then the issue is, what am I going to do? Okay. Well, I know nalorphine is in the dog lab at Illinois. So the nurse is continuing to ventilate the patient. So we're just ventilating her, we're bagging her. It's called bagging, giving her oxygen, and she's doing okay, but now she's going to be that way for hours, I don't know how long, a long time. And we're just bagging her, and so I contact my attending, and I tell him, I said that I overdosed her. And he says, oh my God, and what are we going to do? I said, well, we can ventilate her, and continue ventilating her as we are. I said, I got a drug. It's in the dog lab. And he says, well, where'd you get it from? I said, well, it's a Merck compound. I said, it's called nalorphine, and we're using it to show students and dogs that this works. He says, well, has it ever been given to humans? I said, well, I think they're doing some work at Lexington on this compound. And he says, well, he says, can you get, so he says, is it safe? I said, this is a safe drug. I said, it's been given, it's been published. And so I told him all about this. He says, my God, can we get some? I said, yeah, I can get it right away. He says, well, is it sterile? I said, yeah, it's in sterile form. we got it from Merck. It's they're going to test it in humans. And so he says, well, can you get some? And maybe we can give it to her. And he says, but she has no family. And he says, well, what are we going to do? He says, well, we can continue veiling her, and hopefully she'll come around, or maybe we'll give her this drug and it'll save her life or so. He says, go get it. If you can get it, give it her. I'm telling you the truth.
an amazing story. It really is.
So anyway, I call Ed Pelican, my colleague in pharmacology. Tell him, I said, Ed, I need some nalorphine. I said, it's on the shelf, so-and-so. He knew exactly where it was. We were using it to show medical students that this is the new miracle drug to antagonize morphine. And as a result, he brought it over. I gave it to her, and you wouldn't believe. I gave it to her intravenously. And first thing you know, she's going, she's breathing like that, like a train, like a train, like that, okay? And that's the first thing that happened. She's breathing like that, and she wakes up, opens her eyes. Now her pupils were before were constricted, now they're dilated. She looks at me, she says, oh, hi, Dr. Domino. And then a few minutes later, she says, oh, I'm hurting so much. Can you believe it?
So did she ever know? Did you tell her what happened? Or
I told her later on what happened.
And she lived for
a while, and then she was transferred to a nursing home where she passed away.
Yeah.
Okay. The nurses thought I was God. The attending couldn't believe it. I was known as the professor.
So there you got your PhD.
Not only that, I became a pharmacologist.
So that really did turn you toward
pharmacology. Oh, that turned me into, the audio. But not only that, I had experiences as an intern that you wouldn't believe. You wouldn't believe. Because it was an environment in which there were no or very few residents. And it's you and the doc. You and the attending. And the attending's got to sleep sometime or do other things. And suddenly you're the doc. And I've had experiences that you wouldn't believe, many related to use of drugs, in which I've had some of the most remarkable drug experiences that I've ever had in my life. Because, by the way, at Cook County Hospital, when we had an overdose of heroin, we would just allow them to lay in the halls, and we'd ventilate them periodically and give them picrotoxin or some other convulsant to try and stimulate respiration, and it really didn't work. And sometimes there were so many of the overdose heroin cases around that there weren't enough people to ventilate them, and they'd have to make a decision of triage: who's going to let die, and who's going to let live.
And this was in the 1950s.
You bet it was.
When?
You bet it was. I graduated in 1951. And I had my experiences were unbelievable, because I had all the Cook County experiences, you see, and which I thought, this is not medicine, this is primitive care, which is why I wanted to go to a private hospital, because I had the experience with a Cook County hospital. I said, I want something better.
Yeah.
And it was.
Prior to your experience at Cook County with the heroin ODs, had you known anybody who was addicted to opiates? Or
well, only addicts, as they come in off the street, usually in overdose cases.
Mm-hmm.
If the old Cook County is, believe me, those are experiences that you have to go through yourself to even believe they existed. There wasn't enough medical care. Okay, I mean And I remember, if heroin overdose, you give them picotoxin or you ventilate them and you do the best they can, but you got other people dying from gunshot wounds or God knows whatever. Everybody's running around like crazy trying to help those who are the sickest, that need the most attention. But anyway, that was a major change in my life. And ultimately, word got around. I published that case, by the way. That's one of my publications, a case report. And of course, in the meantime, Wickler and his Isabel are doing the same thing down in Washington.
And they had the same problem. They overdosed a couple people on methadone in a large study.
I didn't know that.
And that's how they came to use nalorphine. Same story. Same kind of situation.
Really?
You know, it's a big methadone study, and it was actually cumulative, you know, sort of fairly low doses, but it was cumulative doses.
Oh, so you get accumulated.
Two guys got into trouble.
Okay.
Were cyanotic.
And they
tell us, you know, it's a similar sort of story of, we realized we had this Naline. Merck was calling it. On the shelf.
Yeah.
And, we tried, there was another thing, like nicotinamide?
Nicotinamide, yeah, that's a convulsant stimulant.
So that's
no good.
Similar to what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's no good. We use nicotinamide, too. That's
right, so
chloramine.
They had tried the standard therapies.
Right.
And there had been a couple, they claim that there had been a couple clinical reports, one in which the guy had died and one in which the guy had lived. And so it was pretty unclear what, you know, whether this was going to work. And they decide to try it, and they revive within minutes.
Well, it was a miracle. It was a miracle. Okay, and we would demonstrate that miracle in dogs to medical students. We said, this is the coming thing. I mean, this is new. When you get out, you're going to be using it. And so I had that experience, and that convinced me.
Yeah.
I'm going to go in. And then, of course, in the meantime, I decide that I'm going to now become a pharmacologist, but I'm also going to do a residency, and that's a separate story of where I'm going to do my residency, and for a variety of reasons, I end up at Michigan. And I first see the people in neurology here at Michigan, because I'm going to be doing my clinical training rather than straight pharmacology. But then I find out that the residency at Michigan gives you $25 a month, and I have a pregnant wife and that's just delivered a baby shortly thereafter, and I need money, and then my wife then gets pregnant again, and I'm in bad shape financially. And I can't live at as a resident. I don't have enough money. And what do you know? I talked to Carl Pfeiffer about a job, and maybe in pharmacology. And he says, "Why don't you go see my friend Mo Sievers at Michigan?" And so, at a meeting, a federation meeting, I then end up. I send out curriculum vitae to a lot of people in pharmacology, and two answer, one from Seattle, where I was going to do my original training at Kings County Hospital, and the other, of course, was Mo Sievers. I met with Mo Sievers, and actually through one of his graduate students, but it was set up by Pfeiffer. That's how I got my job here.
Oh, so what were your initial impressions of him, Sievers?
I was told by Pfeiffer he was a very good, solid pharmacologist, and that he would be a very good boss for me. He said, "Watch it, though. He's a tough one, but watch him. You do the right thing, and he'll do right by you." My Klausuna said, "He's not that good of a theoretician, and he's not that good of a researcher." And I said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" And he says, "Well, he doesn't publish as much as he should. He's more interested in drug addiction and the big picture and its relationship to to society, and you know." Klaus wanted me to, you know, focus on that. So he warned me. But he said, probably a good job. And so both of them recommended me, and I ended up here. And I'll never forget the first day on the job. I come in and I meet with his secretary. So I'm here to see Dr. Severs. And, oh, fine, okay, start to work. The door is open a little bit, and I hear go to see Dottie Norton was her name. Go to see Mo Severs. And she says, Dr. Domino is here. He says, who? I'll never forget it. I'm sitting outside. He's saying, who? And she says, oh, he's from University of Illinois. He's the one that you're hiring for. He said, oh, yeah. Okay, send him in. And I hear the whole conversation. But I'm trying to negotiate getting a assistant professorship because I'm an instructor at University of Illinois in pharmacology. I want to be an assistant prof. And I keep negotiating with him. He says, look, he says, you're going to be an instructor. He says, if you don't like it, the hell with you.
It was very blunt.
Very. Oh, Mo had a way of communicating. You know exactly what he was thinking. Always. And that's what I loved about him. You knew where you stood. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to second guess anything.
So why did he want you? You know, he was running a monkey colony, and he didn't have any experience with non-human primates.
I'm an expert on skeletal muscle relaxants. Okay, I have nothing to do with monkeys. Oh, he heard that I did some. I gave a patient.
So he'd heard that story.
Yeah, he heard that one. He said, what's a big deal? We knew about that. I've been doing that to dogs for years and teaching the Japanese all about it. What's the big deal? And Wickler's doing it anyway down in Isabel. They did a really good study, and you're one case and means nothing. You know, that was unimpressive, okay? But what was impressive is that I was a solid MD that I could then handle, and then my job. I'll never forget, what's your job? You know, I asked him, well, what do you expect of me? He says, I want you to do a good job. Okay, he says, if you do a good job, make the university look good, you'll make me look good. And I can keep my job. That's rule number one, okay? Rule number two, keep the medical students off my back. He says, you don't have to be a really great professor, but you got to be good enough that I don't hear a lot of complaints of how terrible you are. I should tell you that the year before, Mark Nickerson flunked half of the medical class in pharmacology, and the dean as well chewed out Mo Severs. For how could the department flunk half of the medical students? And since Mark Nickerson was an associate professor and his grade counted, the chairman and the dean couldn't change the grade. The students had to take the course over again. Half of the medical class, that's 100 medical students, that summer, I come in the fall, that summer half the medical class are taking pharmacology over again.
Oh, so you had some students who were not and very happy to be there.
And he became known as Black Nick. Black Nick. Okay, later there's a communism story
Red
related
Nick,
to...
Yeah.
Yeah, but Red Nick. But now he's Black Nick. Oh. Like, keep the damn medical students off my back because he was going nuts and the dean was chewing them out. I mean, it was a real problem, okay? And then he had a third rule. He says, whatever you do, okay, since you're hired by the university and hired by me, he says, the only one who's going to take care of me in this university is me, the chairman. He says, I'm responsible for you, and I want to know what you're doing. As long as whatever you're doing is good, you got to let me know. You're going to consult with industry, you talk to me first. Okay, you do whatever you do. You want to practice medicine on the side? I don't recommend that. I said, but I only got a 9-month job. You only gave me 9 months salary. He says, yeah, if you're any good, I'll promote you. I said, well, what do I do with the other 3 months salary? He said, well, you can go find your own money, support yourself. You can take the 9 months salary and spread it out over 12 months and live on that. I said, yeah, but I got 2 kids and a wife. I got to support. He says, well, he says, I don't recommend you to be in private practice. He says, well, there is an alternative. And I said, well, what's the alternative? I said, well, he says, I'll tell you, if you want to work for me in the monkey colony, I'll hire you for the summer on research. Oh, that sounds good. So what do you know? Now I'm introduced to the monkey colony after 9 months as a pharmacologist.
So what do you think of the monkeys? How do you...
Let me tell you about them. Monkeys are 6 to a cage. Okay, in those days.
Oh,
6 to a cage.
Yes.
There's the macho monkey that's in charge, okay? The big macho, you know, all muscle, little brains, but he's the macho monkey in charge, okay? And then he's got his next in command is usually his best girl, okay? So he's got, it's the macho monkey, and then the second one is his girlfriend, okay? Then there's the next guy, he's down on the social ladder a little bit, okay? And then he's got a girlfriend. Okay, and then there's a third male, and he's got a girlfriend. So they end up with a nice, or if the males don't get along, then you'll get he may take if some of the younger monkeys start to get too dominant and do too much fighting, male against male, they'll reduce the number of males and put in more females. Mm. Okay, So seldom does a macho have a harem, but sometimes that happens too. I mean, it depends on the monkey and who's more dominant. Okay, so I'm now introduced to the monkey colony. Okay, and it turns out that a bunch of technicians are the ones who introduced me. But there's a guy by the name of Jerry Deneau in the background who's a graduate student. Okay, and Sam Irwin is in there, but Sam's about to leave. But anyway, Sam Irwin is there. Jerry Deneau, and they're gonna teach me the ropes on grading, scoring monkey withdrawals, etc. But the bottom line to all of this is, I'll never forget it. I go in the first day. I go in to the monkey colony area, and. I have to be, I'm TB, I was TB positive when I went through medical school. Christ, the whole issue of do I have TB or not, but it turns out that I had a calcified TB node, and then now I became negative. Don't ask me why, but in any event, it's a long story. But anyway, I was finally cleared to work with the monkeys. First day I come in, they grab me and they said, they take me and they throw me into a colony of monkeys that are going back and forth. I said, holy Christ, what have I got into? This is incredible. I can't take it. So I yelled to get out of there while the monkeys are going back and forth like that. And I said, this is impossible. He says, well, you get used to it. And I go to see Dr. Severs. I don't want to tell him I'm scared to death. I really am. And I said, Dr. Severs, I said, you know, I really don't think that I'm good for this kind of research. I said, he said, well, why not? I said, well, you know, I can't tell one monkey from another. He says, that's your problem. He says, He said, I want you to go sit outside at the Diag. Now, by the way, we have the big old pharmacology building is right on the Diag of the university, okay? And all the dogs are barking so undergraduate students are walking on the dog on the Diag, and they're always hearing the dogs barking. That's pharmacology, okay? It's unreal, but that's pharmacology in the medical school. So anyway, I'm sitting out on the Diag eating my lunch. He says, tell me if all the people look alike. So I come back off the Diag, beautiful day, and he says, well, is there all people look alike? No, quite different. He says, that's right, same with monkeys. He says, you learn it. He says, go learn your monkeys, you'll be all right. So I got to earn a salary. I'm hired for the summer. I got to do this damn monkey work. Gee, what am I going to do? This is not my area. And so now I'm not introduced to the head of the technician. I said, how in God's name do you handle your monkeys? He says, you got to show them who's boss. I said, what do you mean, you show them who's boss? He says, yeah, you're bigger than they are. You show them who's boss. You let the macho monkey know that you're in charge. I said, well, how do you know that? He says, well, you have to have a badge of authority. I said, what do you mean, badge of authority? He says, well, he goes out and he pulls out a broom, you know, that cleans out toilets. He says, clean out the toilets. And he says, here, this is your badge of authority. I said, what the hell do you do with it? I said, do you swat the monkeys with it? Oh, no. You don't swat the monkeys with that. You rub them, and they can't stand the bristles of the toilet brush. He says, they go nuts over that. So he said, all you got to do is you show them the badge of authority. And if they get a little, they go, they're getting at you. You just take and you rub it against their skin. And they can't stand it.
Never thought that would be your lab equipment.
I'm not kidding you. And you don't swat them. No, you don't. They learn that you're in charge and they can't stand to have their skin rubbed with this, you know, bristles.
Yeah. So was he himself, Sievers, good with the monkeys?
Yes. Of course, that's how he got bit by the colonel.
With the toilet brush?
No. All the, you know, they didn't defang these monkeys and in those days. And some of the monkeys had fangs at least an inch and a half big.
I had no idea.
Well, I'm telling you, and in fact, Dr. Sievers, a number of years later, was in one of the cages with the monkeys. And apparently, he's getting older and he doesn't have as much experience, and they don't know who he really is. Maybe he didn't demonstrate his badge of authority. He got bit in the butt with the fangs, right into the butt. And he got really a severe bite in the buttocks, really severe. And ultimately, the colonel was such a terrible monkey. He was such a macho monkey. Ultimately, they had to anesthetize him and put him to sleep.
And is it true that Sievers had his skull?
Yes. Yeah. On his desk. But one other thing on his desk. One of the most beautiful plants when it blooms you'll ever imagine. A little Forfia Willemsini. Well, just what I said. And that's peyote. Did you ever see peyote in bloom?
Mm-mm.
It's the most beautiful, lovely little thing, gorgeous thing in bloom.
So
and La Forfala Willemsini would be in bloom on his desk. It was absolutely precious to see. I've got pictures of that way back when, I don't know.
Really?
Well, I have pictures of LaMorpha Willemsini in bloom from his desk. And I loved it so much that I asked for one of the little peyote cacti, okay, which he gave me, okay. And I was growing it, and I'll never forget it. I put it outside. It was growing beautifully. This is one little peyote thing. And put it outside, and overnight, one of the rabbits ate the damn thing. So I only ended up with the roots. Okay, I never was able to grow the peyote plant as beautifully as he was. Of course, now it's in our botanical gardens area behind lock and key. And no one can actually see these except under very rare occasions. Since
his plant?
Whether they are some of his originals, I'm not sure.
Because he did have a plant, bonsai, in...
He gave most of his bonsais, or ultimately were given, through Ray Rudden, who took over his house. Mm. Ray's here now as a full professor. Mm. But he became chairman and then took over Seaver's bonsai collection. And then Ray subsequently then gave much of it to the university. And the university has some of that collection. By the way, all of that, I don't know whether you... All of these stories are...
Yes,
are part
I do
of this
have
book.
That.
Yeah,
I do have
well,
that.
But and these are some of my stories.
Yes. Yes.
But in any event, that's the bottom line to my introduction to addiction. I said, who wants to be in the field of addiction? I mean, then no way I'm interested in addiction. But I'm working with the monkeys. I got to know the monkeys very well. And to me, morphine was something very important as a compound, etc. And then, of course, what happens is now the Korean War is on. In the meantime, Seavers has been getting a lot of money from the army. And that's been going on for some time.
To do what?
Well, a secret. Nobody knew.
Do you know now?
What?
Do you know now?
Oh, yeah. But the answer is... during the Korean War and before, the Army had the idea that chemical warfare would become very important, and that rather than use of atom bombs, that maybe preserving a population would be better than totally destroying it. In other words, that you'd still have the buildings and the people there, etc. But basically, you'd want to incapacitate them. And so, what better way of incapacitating them than to get them high? And so, for a long time, they were interested in getting hallucinogens. So that they got involved in hallucinogens.
Mm-hmm. As incapacitating agents. Was this the incapacitating agents program?
Well, yeah.
Sort of Army Chemical
Center. Yeah, the Army Chemical Center, that's correct. And then it turns out that they're looking at all kinds of things. They're looking at hallucinogens, they're looking at amphetamine hallucinogens, and then they're looking at red oil compounds. I was trained in chemistry at University of Illinois in Urbana, where they were working on the red oil derivatives, which are marijuana derivatives. So I knew from chemistry days that University of Illinois Chemistry Department was developing marijuana analogs or derivatives of some kind. But no one knew the structure of marijuana, active ingredient then. And so the bottom line is I knew about red oil. And then Seavers asked me if I wanted to do some further research for him on another contract of some kind of his, which turned out to be an Army contract. And now I had to be screened but he didn't want to tell me what it was. So initially, I was not privilege to what was going on. Nor was another fellow by name of Harry Hardman, and another graduate student who's sitting next door, Ben Lucchese. He's sitting right over there, two doors away from me.
I noticed.
And we're all given oils. We're given a bunch of oils, and our job is to do is to work with them, and my job is to give the oils to dogs and especially monkeys. Because after all, I'm a monkey expert.
Was this after the first summer, or?
Oh, this is after. Yeah, now now the time is going on. So, but I'm being supported by Seavers' program because I need to find my own money. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, Seavers is telling me, he says, you know, you're now I promoted you assistant professor, but you're never going to make it to associate unless you are show me your complete independence. You can't be dependent on me. I don't want you to do the kind of research that I do. Listen to me. You're going to do something else. You're not going to do the research that I do. So I'm staying away from addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I wasn't going to go into the field of addiction. I'm kind of told to stay away from it. That's his area. But I want to develop myself into something. And he wants you to find your own money. Okay? All of these are all part of the deal. But he also has projects with the industry, and every once in a while he'll ask me to do something, and then I'll get a paycheck for doing something, or whatever. But here, the Army project is wonderful, because I'm now given these lousy oils. We don't know what they are, but they're oils, goofy oils of some kind that we got from the Army, and our job is to inject them either into dogs or monkeys. And since I'm more a monkey guy and Harry Hardman's more a dog guy, we're working together and doing our thing, okay? And we hire then Ben Lucchese to do mouse work on analgesic. This darn stuff, this oil is analgesic, but how you get any solution? You used to put it in acetone and dissolve it. I'll never forget, I said, have you ever injected acetone into animals? I said, that's a poison. I say, yeah, but it's not soluble. What are you going to put it in? You can't inject it as such. We used to put the stuff in acetone and inject it, and then we decided Ben Lucchese was a pharmacist originally, so he learned to prepare these oils in something better. So they were in some kind of emulsification solution. So we used to use this stuff intravenously. And I'll never forget what happened. You give it to a monkey, and the monkey would go tranquilized. I mean, if you're high, you get tranquilized, right? You spaced out. I got a spaced out monkey. You give a bigger, and then Dr. Seer says, well, give a bigger dose. I said, we got to know whether it's lethal. So we give a big dose, and the monkey's in a coma. And so Dr. Seer says, well, how long are they in coma?
I got one really crappy one. You want to see it?
Well, we don't know. I said, well, give them IV solutions. We got to know how long it lasts. I said, are they going to die? Or, well, you know, do a good job. You're a pharmacologist. Tell me what this is doing. We had monkeys that would be treated with this red oil stuff, or this oily stuff, that for 1 week would be in this hibernation state. Their body temperature would come down. Artificial hibernation, the most dogs in our, all we do is give them fluids, put them to one side, another, give them nursing care, you know, minimal care, IV fluids, that's all. And a week later, they wake up and be normal. We got a miracle. We got a miracle. What is this? On the bottles, it had the empiric formula. It had no nitrogen in it. You know, most chemicals have nitrogen in it. This had no nitrogen in it. And Harry and I are discussing, what's going on, all it's all about? So, well, there's no nitrogen in it. My God, what is this stuff? Harry says, well, there's an empirical formula. He says, maybe I should go over to a medicinal chemistry librarian for help. I say, yeah, great idea. Harry, go over there. Go do it. So he goes over to the medicinal chemistry library. And they have the empirical formula. He comes back to me. He says, Ed, he says, this is red oil. I says, "You're kidding me. These are marijuana derivatives?" Yeah, he says, "Yeah, that's what it look." He said, "This is what it is. We're looking at the empiric formula. These are the Roger Adam compounds that I knew about from my days in chemistry at University of Illinois." So, good Lord, unbelievable! He says, "Well, we better go see Zevers. Tell him that we're working with marijuana analogs." So we set up an appointment to see Zevers. So, and here he goes, says Dr. Zevers. He says, "We're working with Reto." He said, "Well, how do you know that?" He said, "Well, we went to the library." He says, "Jesus Christ." He says, "As of now," he says, "this is a secret project. Okay, I'm swearing you to secrecy right now." While we're there,
so he didn't know it?
He knew it. Of course.
We didn't know it.
We didn't know it. Now he calls up Edgewood Arsenal. And I forget who he talked to. There's a very important guy that he talked to. He later became a very important for me. A guy by the name of Pitt or somebody like that. And then there's another guy that was very important there. But the Army Chemical Center is very important. And a connection back to Illinois, where another Kaz Kimura was there, who helped me get into pharmacology at University of Illinois. So now Kaz Kimura is in Army Chemical Center with this other guy, who's the head of the whole thing. Not Amadeo Marazzi, another guy. Amadeo was the more basic science pharmacologist, MD, by the way. And then there was another one, guy like Pitt or something is his name. Okay. I forgot his name. But anyway, gets him on the phone, we're there. He says, "Christ, these guys know what we're working on." He said, we need to check them out for clearance. Well, that was easy because I had secret clearance in the Navy, so I was cleared right away. Then Harry was cleared. And then I don't know whether Ben Lucchese was cleared. But anyway, Harry and I were cleared. And from then on, working on with marijuana derivatives. And now I'm doing EEG work and implanted electrodes. And Jerry Deneau is getting mad at me. Jerry's becoming the guy running the monkey colony. He's now the big guy in charge. And there's a difference of opinion. And I'm staying away from drug abuse as far as I can, but I'm working with marijuana analogs. Jesus Christ. But in fact, that led to a little bit of a problem because then I wanted my own monkeys. I had to get everything through Jerry, and I arranged a deal with Zevers that I had my own monkeys. Right. Right. There was a lot of infighting among us.
Yeah.
And ultimately, Jerry Deneau ended up as one of my best friends. Mm. It's a long story, very much. He ended up ultimately in Jackson, Mississippi.
Why did he go there?
Jerry had a drinking problem. We knew that when he was a medical student, or a PhD. He was a PhD. He had a drinking problem. He enjoyed liquor, but he was a very good researcher. Ultimately, he did have a drinking problem and got it cured. Hmm. He went through and then, because of his experience, became a wonderful, and that's the only word, it's a wonderful story with Jerry Deneau. He became a one of the treatment people. He was, I don't know what you call him, but he was involved in the treatment of drug abuse.
A counselor?
Counselor. He had a huge counseling service at the biggest Baptist hospital in Jackson, Mississippi.
Gosh.
Huge.
Well, I didn't know that.
Jerry Deneau ended up his career as an outstanding person who had his own experiences with drug abuse, not only personal experience, but also research-wise. He was a real expert in this area, and a superb counselor.
Yeah.
And then he passed away. But that's what may have happened to Jerry Deneau. But a very important guy, very important guy, along with Duncan McCarthy, who ended up at Park Davis, etc.
So Duncan was one of the students?
He was one of the students, as was Jerry Deneau. And then Duncan was Seaver's student, but worked with Jerry. And Duncan always had, again, I had a concern. I got my own, I'm an independent guy, and these guys are running the monkey colony, and I'm kind of horning in on their monkey territory. Yet I need my own monkeys, and I have to use the same technicians they do. And and we're saying, well, which monkeys can I have? Which can they have? Etc. And don't give me the junk monkeys. They're in bad shape. I need good monkeys. So we had some personal interactions there. And whenever it happened, I'll never forget it, the Seaver Solutions. Jerry and I had a difference of opinion, or Duncan and I had a difference of opinion. We'd go up see Dr. Seavers. He says, we'd tell him what the problem is. He'd look us both in the eyes as I look at me. He says, I'll give you 1 hour to settle this problem. You go outside, you come back in an hour. If you can't settle it, both of you are fired. Woo! Woo! What a man! You can't work together. You don't belong here. What a man.
Yeah.
What a man.
So at the time, would you have admired that, or would you have resented it?
At the time, over the years, I came to admire the man for his honesty, for his saying the way it is, always. And that's what he taught me, and that got me into a lot of trouble. Oh boy, have I been into trouble for the University of Michigan, but I learned something from him. He said, if it's for the good of the university, you do it. If you have trouble, in a nice way you explain what it is, but if it's for the good of the university, in the end, it'll turn out right. And he's always been right. And I've had many a battle at this university in which, if it's for the good of the university, ultimately some administrator at some higher level will say, hey, yeah, that's the right thing to do. And by the way, Seavers was the first to abolish smoking machines at University Hospital, and yet he's accused of being in with the tobacco industry, because he would interact with everybody. He's the kind of a guy that would act at the political level, but at the personal level, he'd get all of the people together, etc. He had very strong opinions. For example, he didn't feel that nicotine was addicting. I think the day he died, he didn't think it was addicting, because it didn't produce a withdrawal syndrome in the same category as morphine and especially alcohol. Alcohol addiction will kill you. And so Seavers always would kind of break down different times of addiction on the basis of how serious it is from the point of view, are you going to live or die? But nevertheless, he's been criticized, especially by anti-tobacco people, a lot, unnecessarily and inappropriately.
Strange. Yeah.
Inappropriately.
Seems so to me as well. I've run into some of that on the internet.
I think the man is a jewel.
Yeah.
So the answer is, we came to respect the man, and we both realized, we're all working for the same good of the department and ultimately all for ourselves. So I ultimately ended up with all of these people as friends.
Right, right. And your main conflict was really with Jerry Deneau, not with Duncan.
Yeah, and then later on with Duncan. I had similar problems.
So when
Duncan.
Did Duncan go to
when
Mark
he
Davis?
Goes to industry, now he's now I start getting important to industry, and especially to Park Davis in other areas. And then I end up with now we get involved. Now comes in the fencyclidine story. It's amazing. I'm not supposed to be in addiction, because the old man told me I got to do something else. Okay, I got to have my own independence. He made a big point of that. He said, I can't promote you unless you're independent. You can run your own show. And he didn't even want me to collaborate at first with anybody. Do it yourself. You can't do it yourself. I know you're no good.
Was he like that with everybody?
I don't know. He was that way with me.
Yeah. So what you become important to Park Davis before PCP?
Well, yeah, because of skeletal muscle relaxants. They're now trying to develop skeletal muscle relaxants, and now I get through Seavers as the consultant. I get grants through Park Davis to do work here, And that allows me to do my own research in skeletal muscle relaxants, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. And we never came up with really a good one. We came close to it, but never not enough to go clinical. And then I get involved with Park Davis with PCP. And only because Severs, and I got monkeys. Yeah, I've got my own independent show. And Severs says, you know, I got this crazy compound that they're talking about that does funny things to dogs, but they want to get a workup. And why don't we do a bunch of monkeys? Okay, so I then do my monkey research and brainwaves and all of that sort of stuff. I can't believe it. PCP is this incredible anesthetic in monkey. It's incredible. It's the only word. It's incredible. So I get a reputation there for with PCP, and then, believe it or not, the people at Lafayette Clinic, who are psychiatrists, hear about my PCP work. They're doing it in humans, and they say, you know, this thing is a model for schizophrenia. And they contact Severs. And Severs says, calls me up one day, he says, Ed, you know, you're still on a 9-month appointment. I said, how would you like to have a nice consultantship? And I said, sure, what? He says, well, you can work for the Department of Mental Health. I said, for how long? He says, well, for 3 months. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you can take 9 months and spread it over 12 months. So you're now 9/12. You can take 3 months, spread it over 12 months. That's 3/12. And that you'll be part-time at the university, part-time wherever they want you. Some guy at the Lafayette Clinic wants to have you consult on PCP, and you've been doing a lot of monkeys here. So I end up now as a consultant to the Department of Mental Health.
So PCP was, it's Calvin, who developed it?
All right, the two people, Chen, Graham Chen, is the one who first discovered PCP on the basis of injecting it into mice. And he couldn't believe the kind of pharmacology that it had. And when it was given, and we're the ones who did all the monkey work on it, and it turned out to be a superb anesthetic in monkeys. Now, they twitched a little, but they didn't have much in the way of emergence delirium like people do. Mm-hmm. And so it was very logical that it be used as an anesthetic. And then it turned out that it was first used in Detroit as a anesthetic agent, and which was great. It was an excellent anesthetic, except it caused emergence delirium. Mm-hmm. And that's how they got the psychiatrists at the Lafayette Clinic interested in what's going on with these people going nuts during emergence delirium, you know? So that's how I got involved, and that led to a 25-year relationship with the Lafayette Clinic, in which I was always on a 9-month appointment at the University of Michigan.
And the Lafayette Clinic was a state-run mental health.
It was one of the best psychiatric state research hospitals in the United States, and turned down, and then about 20 years ago, killed by our governor for a lack of money. The major decision was made that in the state of Michigan that we didn't have enough money, and that supporting psychiatric research hospitals was not a right thing to do, and one of the best in the country was destroyed.
Yeah. So somehow the Lafayette Clinic had some relationship with Park Davis?
No direct relationship. Although ultimately Park Davis and then subsequently through me, Warner Lambert, I used to get money from to work with humans at the Lafayette Clinic, because mm-hmm. Lafayette Clinic was more people-oriented. Mm-hmm. And I fit in beautifully, because here I am, an MD, and my MD...
Right, so finally you get to go back to people and...
Well, no, I did a lot of people stuff here.
Here.
A lot. I've worked with in Alzheimer's patients. Mostly mentally normal old geriatric patients who want to improve their memory. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of stuff. I did all of the Jackson Now ketamine comes in a big way.
Okay, now slow down. Tell, because I was going to ask you, did you also test PCP at Jackson?
No.
Before ketamine?
No.
No.
No. Griefenstein, the anesthesiologist at Wayne State, was the first in the world to test fencyclidine in humans as an anesthetic agent. And he and his people showed that it had emergence delirium. So he contacted Jack Gottlieb and Elliot Luby at the Lafayette Clinic to ask for their help as to whether these people were hallucinating or what they were doing, or was this just like ether emergence delirium. And so Elliot Luby in particular at the Lafayette Clinic then did infusions of PCP in both normals and psychiatric patients, and to his astonishment concluded it was the best model of schizophrenia that we had.
Right, so that was in the context of LSD and other
psychotomimetic
drugs.
Right. And then now in the meantime I'm doing my thing and I'm going independent. By the way, one of the problems that I had was get my own money, because Severs made it very clear to me that I could not live off of him and that I had to be independent. See, that's why I'm not an addiction specialist.
I keep denying it.
And I have these monkeys and I have these dogs with implanted electrodes, by the way, where we were doing these army compounds, getting brain waves and all these marijuana, and they're all marijuana analogs, and they're doing these amazing things. And I'll never forget, one day I had a very hyperactive dog and measuring brainwave activity, and my colleague in a postdoc fellow from Japan, who smoked like a fiend, but nevertheless, this dog is jumping around on the brainwaves. I can't get any brainwave recordings. All of a sudden, I'm on one side of a one-way mirror, and he's in the other room. All of a sudden, the brainwaves become so beautiful and so normal, and then they change into a pattern that I've never seen in my life. I said, "My God, what's going on?" I run into the other room. Shawa Wakey was his name, from Japan. I said, "Shawa, what's going on? What's happened to the dog?" He said, "Well, nothing." I said, "Yeah, but what did you do?" It was all excited. And I said, "Well, what'd you do?" He said, "Well, I blew smoke in its nose." And I said, "What?" He says, "Well, it's a way I keep them calm." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "I just take them, blow in his nose, and they calm down." He says, "That's all I did." He said, "Really?" I said, "Do it again." And the dog's kind of normal now, and he blows smoke in the nose. And God, I get these in the amygdala. I'll never forget it. I get this big, big pattern in the amygdala. I said, "Oh my God, this is the limbic system. What is going on?" I said, "This is smoke, tobacco, source of money."
Yeah.
And so I go run to Severs and I tell him what's happening. He says, "Go apply for a grant." I said, "Well, where?" He says, "Well, there's a tobacco council. They're doing, the tobacco industry set up something in New York. You apply to them." So I immediately called, got the application. I applied to them. I immediately write up a grant, okay, on this amazing effect of tobacco smoke, and send it in. In the meantime, we try different kinds of things. I try marijuana smoke, marijuana burn leaves. I take tobacco. I take regular grass for clippings. And then I take even burnt paper, rags. They all do the same thing. I said, "Holy God, I got a grant on," and then I get funded on tobacco. In the meantime, everything I blow into the nose of the dog does the same thing, brainwave-wise. Hey, what's going on? So then we find out that there. It, by the way, we found the basis of sniffing. I can tell you now why we sniff. Okay? And that is, you when you blow, when you suck air through the nostrils very rapidly, the cilia move there, okay, and they move, and now they sensitize to the additional amount of chemical coming in. Mm. So you can sniff, you smell better, and you get a better response, and that's what we proved in subsequent dog research. And so I'm the first in the world, and nobody still believes us. We published that in Neurophysiology Journal that we've discovered the basis of sniffing, but I've never been given credit for that.
That's great.
Yeah, but that now gets me started on nicotine.
No. Go back and do ketamine, because we didn't really do that.
So, well, it turns out that I get a call from a fellow at the then Park Davis, Alex Lane. And Alex knows that I really am a clinical pharmacologist, that I do animal research, but I really do get to do work in people, okay? And I've had that reputation from day one. So Alex calls me up and he says, Ed, we got a PCP analog here that we'd like to have you look at. And now Duncan McCarthy is at Park Davis. And Duncan's not too happy with me. We still are not the best of friends, because he thought he was the boss in the monkey colony. And, you know, there's some relationship there. But in any event, Alex calls me and tells me all about this compound. He says, it's all been worked up by Duncan McCarthy. I said, well, what does it do in monkeys? He says, it's superb. It's the only word, superb short-acting anesthetic. He says, and I said, would you want to consider doing this work at either U Hospital or wherever? I said, well, I'm not an anesthesiologist. I said, I'd have to get a colleague in anesthesia, but I said, I'd love to do it. But I said, before we do it, I want to do it in monkeys. That's me. My model is monkeys, or dogs, or monkeys. So then I got a colleague, Gunter Corson, in anesthesiology here, who got an award from Hitler for fighting the Russians. So he's got the big cross or so from Hitler for fighting communists, okay? So even though he's the Jewish people here in this community know he got a medal from Hitler, he's very proud of the fact that he fights communism. So Gunnar and I get together, and now I showed this amazing PCP derivative of ketamine in monkeys. He says, Christ, Ed, this is unbelievable. It's a beautiful anesthetic agent, no emergence delirium. I said, yeah, but let's do it in dogs. I said, because dogs are different. So we do it in dogs, and dogs are weird. They wake up and they're crazy. I said, we got problems here. I said, you know, we got a species difference, and whether humans are going to be more like dogs or more like monkeys, I don't know. He said, well, we got to try it. Okay.
So wouldn't you have suspected they would be more like monkeys?
Yeah, I thought humans would be more like monkeys.
Okay. But they turn out to be more like dogs.
They're a combination of both.
Oh.
They have beautiful anesthesia like monkeys, but emergence delirium like dogs. Interesting.
Yeah.
Combination. But anyway, the bottom line to all of this is, where are we going to do the work? Whether we're going to do it at U Hospital or where. And that's where Alex says, oh, we have these wonderful facilities at Jackson Prison. So what do you know? Now and we decide, well, we go out to Jackson Prison, we're astonished.
So describe it.
Superb facility, better than U Hospital. My God, it was a prison within a prison. So there's Jackson Prison itself, and within the prison is a separate set of buildings which are now secure by the Warner Lambert, well, by Park Davis and Upjohn facilities to enter into those facilities. And state of the art, that's all I can say, in which there is essentially a small hospital, outpatient as well as inpatient. superb medical facilities of all kinds, state of the art, that's all. Okay. And in fact, anesthesia equipment of all kinds. Gunnar goes in and he wants a few more. We can get carte blanche, whatever you want, state of the art. Okay. And the facilities are so superb, better than U Hospital, that we decide to do the work at Jackson Prison. And it has to go through some kind of a approval through the for doing human research within the Upjohn, and Park Davis had some sort of a board approved research. Okay.
Like an IRB?
It was like an IRB. I don't know what it was called, but it was all done within house. We got approval. By the way, Henry Swain ended up as head of the IRB at Park Davis, and subsequently over the years for Upjohn, and then Pfizer, and then I think recently resigned, retired. Henry Swain, I think for 20 or 30 or maybe 40 years, has been on the IRB of the drug companies here.
Huh.
And he'd give you a wonderful input on relationship industrial IRBs.
Yes.
Because he was head of it. Anyway, the bottom line is, we decide to do the work at Jackson Prison. And I'll never forget it as long as I live. God almighty. First of all, I've never met such wonderful men in all my life as the prisoners that were screened at Jackson Prison for the facilities that we had. We had PhDs, we had, wonderful, just wonderful people. Turned out to be murderers, crooks of all kinds, and stock market, executives that are screwing up. I mean, very intelligent people, and very gifted in convincing you they're just the most marvelous people on earth. And yet they're in prison for all these terrible crimes. I mean, what are you in prison for? Well, I raped a woman and I killed this one. I mean, it's amazing to get their personal stories. But nevertheless, they were all screened for us as being suitable, healthy, perfectly normal, at least for being in
prison.
So
you didn't have anything to do with the screening process and the protocol?
No. Protocol we wrote.
Yes.
Well,
okay.
In conjunction with Alex Lane.
And then they approved.
And then it was approved. And then they were all selected. So Gunnar and I would come in, never forget it. I mean, first time you go into a prison, I never was in a prison before. I mean, it's quite an experience. Really, it's an experience for a person who's never been in a prison. And as you go through all of the places to ultimately get into this facility. And there, our job, we'd go there and the prisoners would be there all properly schemed, ready to go. Everything was done right. Our job was then to give the drug. And I made an agreement with Gunnar Corson. I said, you're the clinician, I'm the clinical pharmacologist. I said, your job is to keep the patient alive, no matter what. Keep that airway open and keep them in good shape. I said, my job, I'll give the drug if you want. And then I want to check all of the vitals, et cetera, as you do. We can have a good anesthesia record. But we're going to work as a team. We're going to take brain waves. We're going to do a lot of things. Okay, so it'll be electrocomplete, heart rate, blood pressure, all recorded on a polygraph. Everything's done right. Okay, and between the two of us, that's the way we ended up. I'll never forget the first patient we gave it to. We gave it to a patient, goes beautifully into a coma-like state, kind of has his eyes open and laying there like a zombie. My God, it's a zombie. Just laying there like that. And Gunnar says, well, pinch him. And he says, well, I'll pinch him. I said, well, he doesn't respond. He says, come on, Ed, pinch him harder. Pinch him harder. He don't respond. He says, well, I said, why don't you really squeeze him really hard? Well, that doesn't hurt. He says, well, squeeze his testicles. I said, yeah, well, okay. I squeeze his testicles. I squeeze them I wouldn't squeeze my testicles very hard. I saw I squeezed a testicle, no response. He said, "My God," he said, "what's going on?" And then the guy wakes up, and he's kind of a little crazy. There is an emergence there. And so I said, this is like PCP. He said, "We got a short-acting PCP. Alex Lane, Duncan McCarthy, who's there, goes bananas with me. Bananas. I'm talking about a PCP derivative that is PCP-like, and they're talking about a compound that has very little emergence delirium." And then I insist that we bring in Elliot Luby from the Lafayette Clinic, who did all the human work on PCP, to Jackson Prison to do the psychiatric evaluation. And they said, no, we got our own psychiatrist. We don't want Elliot Luby. So I agree ultimately after a battle over that. We agree to that. Their psychiatrist comes in. He says, emergence delirium like ether. And then I got the problem, and I said to Gunnar, this is a short-acting PCP. And Gunnar says, "Well, what are we going to do about it?" I said, "Well," I said, "this is very interesting." I said, "This is an important compound. This is something we got to get into humans and work it up. I think we got a real contribution to humanity." And so we work it up. And then when I put all of it together, I got the big problem. What am I going to call this thing? A PCP analog? So I have to call it a PCP analog. But I talked to my wife one day, and I says, "Honey," I said, "I don't know. I got this crazy PCP compound. It's really short acting." I said, but she says, "Well, what do they do?" I says, "Well," I said, "I give it to them. They lay there like a zombie." I said, "They're disconnected, you know, from their environment. They're just laying there and disconnected. And they don't feel any pain or they don't react." And she said, I said, "Some kind of weirdo anesthetic." She says, "Well, you mean a disconnected anesthetic?" "Well, yeah, it's kind of like that. Well, it's kind of there. They're dissociated. I don't know, honey. They're just." She said, "Why don't you call it dissociative anesthetic?" That's what it was. You read the literature now, and you read the dissociative anesthetic. That's my wife.
And what was her name, for the record?
Tony Domino Paczorowski is her Polish name, as a maiden name. But Tony is the one who came up with dissociative anesthetic, and it stuck. Stuck with forever. In the meantime, Duncan and the people at Park Davis are so upset with me. I said, "Look, you call them as you see them." And now I'm, and Seaver's backing me, by the way, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, he says, "Christ, you're dealing with PCP analog. Say what it is." But I showed him. By the way, he was impressed for monkeys. What an anesthetic. My God, it revolutionized anesthesia in monkeys. You know, for veterinary medicine, fabulous contribution. But anyway, the bottom line to all of this is that's I ended up at Jackson Prison doing that work. We did then subsequent work, and so again, I'm into drug. And then when ketamine becomes a drug of abuse and PCP becomes a drug, I can't believe it. I said, "What's this anesthetic? Why are people taking this crazy drug like that?" And then, so now I'm back into drug abuse. I'm into nicotine abuse. And all
no matter how you try to escape it, you're
to this day. And would you believe I just got funded September 15th of this year? After I was told the grant is dead, I got funded for the next 3 years, $1.5 million, to study now tobacco smoking nicotine on release of endogenous opioid substances in humans, okay? Can you believe it? Okay? Because now we're finding that nicotine is releasing an endogenous morphine. Can you believe that? Well, you want...
I can believe that.
It's true. But not only that, in some areas of the brain, it actually releases, and other areas it's anti-release. It's double.
Wow, that is really... So I want to come back and talk about that, but I have to go to the bathroom. So
yeah, and I'm worried about the clock. And
I
let
am
me tell
too.
You, tell you what's going on.
Okay.
It's now 10:26. So yeah. I have a...
Should I stop this?
Please do.
Let me see what I got there.
Well, maybe we can finish that and then end up at that point.
Tell me about Taming the Tiger. Go back up.
Well, we were talking about what happened at Jackson Prison, and it was very clear from the first subject we ran that there was a problem. It wasn't not everybody, I might add. I mean, but I would say a third of people who get a unpleasant reaction that they'll tell you about. Others will get a response that they may find kind of interesting, a kind of a nice floating sensation that they kind of enjoy, and then eventually they become normal. But in any event, after we then studied it in normal subjects, then there was a beautiful anesthesia facility for surgery at Jackson Prison as well, for surgery. So that if there was a surgical problem, that it was handled right at Jackson Prison. And so Gunnar then, who was an anesthesiologist then, would actually on occasion be available to do the anesthesia. And so we then went ahead to use ketamine in patients undergoing surgery, where it was a superb analgesic agent. And again, it had its problems, and from then we went away from Jackson Prison back to University Hospital, where we then did a very extensive study here. And then that became it became very obvious that ketamine was always going to be a problem. It had many advantages, but its big disadvantage was the emergence sequelae. And as a result, when Gunnar left anesthesiology to set up his own facilities at University of Alabama in Birmingham, another young anesthesiologist by name Elmer Zygmunt came from Hungary and ended up here at U Hospital. And Elmer and I then got together of how to tame the ketamine tiger. Now, I actually have a beautiful picture at home I'd love to show you. I got a woman who's an artist, and I gave her a commission to Taming the Tiger, and I have that in the hallway of my house, which involves a picture of a woman spaced out under ketamine, and then the tiger as it's approaching, and the two different kinds of isomers. It's a portrait I have at home.
Wow, so I would like to see it. So how did it become called the tiger?
I called it the tiger because a tame tiger was a wonderful animal. Tiger that's wild, it's got problems. And so I've always felt in my life, if I can tame this beast, if I can tame ketamine, we're going to have a winner. And you should know the latest in that regard. And that's a mixture of propofol and ketamine. Are you familiar with propofol?
No.
Well, you are now. Propofol is an anesthetic agent that looks like milk. Looks like milk when you inject it. Imagine injecting milk into a... Looks like milk when you give it IV. And it has the remarkable effect of essentially anesthetizing you, and you wake up quick. You go down quickly, and you come up quickly, and you're normal. But has no analgesic effect whatsoever. None. Now, if you can add the analgesic effect of ketamine to propofol, you might have a winner. And that combination has been christened by a number of people ketol. Or ketopropol. There have been a number of terms signifying the combination. Okay.
So you're working on that?
I am working on it from a more library research point of view, with a senior medical student that is going into anesthesiology, where we're now going to write a review in this area, pulling the field together. Because but anyway, I'm still trying to tame the tiger.
Yeah. So, your surprise about it becoming a drug of abuse, how does it get out
How because it's easy to make. And furthermore, through a veterinary supply mm-hmm. for many years. In fact, DEA didn't consider it a major drug abuse at all compared to phencyclidine. But clearly ketamine is abused, and now the restrictions on it are severe. And I guess will always be, because people are people, and they'll do what they want. And in fact, I was surprised that phencyclidine was reinforcing. I really was surprised. But apparently animals will bar press, but I don't have that. I don't know that literature. Mm-hmm. Gail Winger is your expert in that mm-hmm. area.
Mm-hmm. Is ketamine?
I'm sure it would be, but I don't know. Not my area.
She and I had a conversation about ketamine and her surprise that it had become a drug of abuse.
She also was surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she'd be perfect for it to ask whether, in fact, monkeys will bar press for it. I would think they would, but it would be my prediction.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I'm interested in doing a little historical article on ketamine specifically. That's why I'm interested in.
You should know that Society of Anesthesiology has asked me to pull all of my ketamine material together, everything that I've ever done in that area, and submit it to the library that they have, a historical library outside of Chicago, for everything related to ketamine, and I'm going to be doing that someday.
Terrific.
As I'm getting older, I'm kind of see the light at the end of the tunnel,
speak. And we should talk about that, because so that is precisely what I have in mind for trying to get the sort of addiction and drugs of abuse related area to do that. It's a problem as a historian. Things are so dispersed.
Exactly.
And you find them in labs still.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
So Seaver's stuff, many of you have bits and pieces in different places.
Right.
You showing me this, you know, this is the kind of thing, right, precisely.
Yeah.
You know, this, you've got an original photograph here. You've got the whole thing is ready to go.
One would have to get permission, obviously, to do it, whatever it is. But nevertheless, here it is. I don't even remember how I got these, but it's part of my, I'm going, I'm downsizing. You'll see how much I have downsized. I used to have an enormous laboratory, and over the years I'm downsizing. And now my latest is strictly more human-related.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be doing much of my work in positron emission tomography at U Hospital.
Yes. I guess we should.
I'd like to relatively soon bring this to a conclusion, simply because my own time is getting pushed. But.
Right.